The Spendthrift 80s, Part 3, Fads, Smurfs, and Hulk Hogan. Now, for a decade, the prize image over reality, what could be more appropriate symbol than the tanning salon? After one visit, you boost the rosy glow of health atop a possible seeds of malignant melanoma. But you looked marvelous. Short term. Very short term, since your skin soon needed a further assault of the ultraviolet irradiation. This may be an exaggeration, but only slightly, for as with others, rosy images of the early and mid-80s, by decades end reality reared its inevitable head. Tanning salons were not as safe as we'd been told. Their lamps were safe ultraviolet A rays, but not all the difference from the sun's burning ultraviolet B rays. In fact, as the FDA reported in 1989, as for long-term damage, the effects of UVA and UVB radiation are essentially the same. Tanning salons were so in during the fitness mania of the 80s that their clients and operators developed the language of Solanese. Pale-skinned customers were called Caspers, as in Casper the Friendly Ghost, while those taking excessively tanned with leathery hides were called Iguanas. Not to even get fake bake, a Casper lay in a clamshell, that's a tanning bed, called out, turn me over, switch on the lamps, and later requested, flip me, turn me over. It was cheaper than a winter vacation to the Caribbean, and sessions could be crammed into one's lunch hour. Customers were lulled into a false security with claims that especially designed lamps were significantly safer than the sun. The actual difference was dangerously marginal. Sunlight contained 1% to 3% UVB rays. A proper functioning tanning bed emitted about 1%. Unfortunately, tanning beds and their accompanying timers were not always well maintained. In addition, the FDA field inspectors found that many owners removed warning labels from tanning beds, did not offer protective eyewear, ignored timers, and never gave clients a rundown of safety measures needed for tanning under lamps. By the start of the 90s, the salons, which were once commonplace in malls and fitness centers, were an endangered species. It remains to be seen if the healthful look of the 90s will be one of natural, untanned complexion. Dealey bobbers. They were bobbing glitter-coated headsets that resembled insect antennas and were all the rage in 1982. A set may now be in a carton in your basement. Quintessential silliness. Dealey bobbers were the brainchild of 38-year-old novelty manufacturer John Minkove of Bellevue, Washington. A set sold for about $2. The wearers looked as if they belonged on the Saturday Night Live set as one of John Belushi's Killer Bee skits. The novelty item was easy to rip off, and indeed, one Stephen Askin of Marine Del Rey, California, claimed that he and his wife concocted the first bobbing antennas in 1981, but failed to move fast enough to gain a patent and make a killing. Askin said he commissioned a manufacturer to produce 2 million bobbers at the cost of 11 cents each, but the fad had crashed by the time he had the product ready for stores. Dealey bobbers, the origin of their name remains a mystery, were a hot item during the Christmas season of 1982. But the headgear, once expected to outsell the Pet Rock and the Rubik's Cube, proliferated into so many cut-price imitations that the fad survived only a few months. Due to cutthroat price competition, one manufacturer walked away a millionaire. Smurfs. Small, plucky, blue gnomes with white stocking caps who generated some $600 million in retail sales at the peak of their popularity in 1982. They were created 25 years earlier by Belgian illustrator Pierre Paul Culliford. The grotesquely adorable creatures, through book illustrations, attracted the attention of European toy manufacturers in the 60s, creating fads in Germany, Italy, Spain, and Scandinavia, where the cuddly pint-sized pixie was known respectively as Schlumpf, Puffo, Piffo, and Schmolf. The Belgian elves' break into a big-time fandom began in 1978 when christening them Smurfs. The British Petroleum launched a promotional campaign based on Culliford's creatures. In England, they spawned Smurfinalia as t-shirts, posters, and even a record, the Smurf Song, that ascended the British charts. In America, the 2-inch-high figurines imported by Los Angeles-based novelty distributor Wallace Berry and Company sold for $1.50 in 1981. The craze mushroomed with NBC president Fred Silverman, impressed by his daughter Melissa's attraction to the troll-like dolls, which she thought, by the way, resembled her father, commissioned Hanna-Barbera creators of the Flintstones to devise a Saturday morning cartoon series. The Smurfs became the showcase for the images and soon appeared on clocks, children's vanity sets, pedal cars, Smurfmobiles, lunchboxes, and transistor radios. The Smurfs were the major toy fad of 1982. Through imaginative licensing of the image, the Smurfs outsold Steven Spielberg's 1982 creation, E.T., as well as George Lucas's Star Wars characters. So popular was the TV show that it drew NBC from last place to first on Saturday morning ratings, was lengthened from a half an hour to 90 minutes, and caused the network to shelve its plans to expand the Today Show on weekends. As people began collecting Smurf, their population grew into 98 male elves with Disney-like monikers like Brainy, Greedy, and Jokey, plus a wise old Papa Smurf and a single blonde female Smurfette. The media punned shamelessly, saying the new craze was Smurfin' USA, and the White House annual egg roll was besmurfed by the gnomes, and inverting Murphy's Law to Smurfy's Law, in which everything that can go right does go right, a phrase that reflected the doll's extraordinary merchandising profits. Though overmarketed, the Smurfs did not fade away as most fads. Instead, by 1984, the coying cute elves had moved into the classification of fairy tale icon that included the enduring Disney characters and ageless comic book heroes. Future generations of preschoolers will never know Smurfs as a fad toy, but as staples of folklore fantasy. Well, let's finish this little section here with, speaking of Smurfs, let's go to another direction. WrestleMania and Hulk Hogan. The decade witnessed the transformation of the ancient sport of strength and agility into a show business arena, some say center ring circus, featuring 300-pound-plus muscle-bound behemoths as the unlikely stars and profitable pop culture icons. Pro wrestling became one of the country's most popular sports. Its practitioners, once unable to earn a living from the game, suddenly were commanding six-figure incomes. Andre the Giant, Rowdy Roddy Piper, Ravishing Rick Rude, the Sergeant Slaughter, became heroes to millions of kids, though the limelight in the 80s was stolen by Hulk Hogan, a.k.a. the Hulkster. Born Terry Jean Bollea, the 6'8", 300-pound Hogan, with flowing blonde locks and 24-inch biceps, was the standard for the decade's superstar wrestler. No one expected Hogan to engage his opponents in legitimate Greco-Roman-style grappling of the sort seen in the Olympics. Rather, what was presented in Vince McMahon's World Wrestling Federation extravaganzas was choreographed roughhousing, staged for drama as much for laughs, for athleticism as much as for stuntman special effects. As if to prove pro wrestling was really entertainment, in 1984 pop star Cyndi Lauper entered the sport as the manager of Captain Lou Albano, while Albano made reciprocal appearances on Lauper's MTV videos. Celebrities from diverse occupations soon entered the ring in one guise or another. Boxer Muhammad Ali debuted as a guest referee, baseball manager Billy Martin as a guest timekeeper. Feminist Gloria Steinem and politician Geraldine Ferraro attended matches, and Andy Warhol visited Madison Square Garden and pronounced the sport hip, exciting. It's America. Sometimes the wrestlers got caught up in the image that they promoted. Hulk Hogan, as a guest on comedian Richard Belzer's cable TV show, Hot Properties, demonstrated a front chin lock on Belzer, rendering him limp, unconscious, and bloody. The comedian's head required 8 stitches. John Stossel, reporter for ABC's 2020, was similarly roughed up when he egged the sport's colossal Dr. D, David Schultz, with a taunt that pro wrestling moves were faked. In 1985, 4 wrestling programs, all produced by World Wrestling Federation, were among the top 10 shows on cable TV. Among the major networks, NBC joined the fray with its Saturday night main event. Merchandisers rushed out Hulk Hogan video cassettes, action dolls, t-shirts, and sweatbands. And at Madison Square Garden, a ringside seat for a bout of the behemoth sold for as much as $200. While WrestleMania started in America, by late in the decade, its stage spectacles were being enjoyed via satellite in 26 foreign countries. Whereas promoters of the sport viewed it as harmless exploitation of homegrown entertainment, many social commentators argued that it contributed to the image abroad of America as the most violent country on the planet. an image backed up by late in the decade by statistics on the high rate of domestic violence and street bloodshed. Well, that takes care of just fads. Now, next time we're going to start looking at toy fads, although a couple of them that we covered in here certainly would have fallen into that category. Now, the source for this is Pinotti's Parade of Fads, Follies, and Manias, The Origins of Our Most Cherished Obsessions by Charles Pinotti. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.